Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Wisconsin's 700,000 residents over age 65 can start getting COVID-19 vaccinations next week, but state officials say vaccinating them and other groups will take months. Karen Timberlake is the state's top health official after Andrea Palm joins the Biden administration. Republican and Democratic senators offer policing reforms that the Assembly Task Force on Racial Disparities will consider. Rewind, your week in review for January 22.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
The process of vaccinating Wisconsinites against COVID-19 is consuming both lawmakers and the Evers administration. Before we let you hear from the governor and the deputy secretary of DHS, let's kind of walk through where things are right now. As of Monday, the DHS announced that those 700,000 residents, Wisconsin residents over 65, can start getting vaccinated as of Monday. Why pick those over 65? Well, yesterday, the deputy secretary said 87% of those that die of COVID-19 in Wisconsin are over the age of 65. Now, very interesting. A panel has recommended that the next round of shots go for teachers, child care workers, grocery workers, utility and transit workers, and prison inmates. More on that later. But both Governor Evers and the deputy secretary said, we're now getting 70,000 doses per week. We need about three times as much as those 70,000 doses. But on a good note, a record number of vaccinations, 22,072, were administered on Wednesday. And the process is likely to, is much akin to getting a flu shot. Work with your pharmacy, your health insurers, local health departments, senior citizen centers. J.R., before we hear from the governor, your thoughts on kind of an overview of where we are in the vaccination process, please?
Well, in talking to people this week, the sense I got was that the troubles that the Evers administration had early on with its plans for the rollout have stabilized a little bit. But there are still some pitfalls ahead. You mentioned that recommendation include prisoners in the next wave of vaccinations. That could be a politically tricky issue if they are included in that next wave. And looking at the numbers, we still lag behind the other 11 kind of Midwestern states, you know, from the Dakotas over to Ohio, in terms of getting these people vaccinated per 100,000 residents. At the same time, we also lag all but two of them in the number of vaccines we've gotten per capita. So there's a supply issue for us that's a little more serious than most of the other states in the Midwestern area. Not sure how much of that plays into the issue, but Governor Evers has been saying that we have a supply issue. They've got a plan to roll it out. They need more vaccines. How they handle that going forward is going to be key, and you're sensing Republicans are still kind of keeping the pressure on the governor about his rollout plans and trying to find ways to poke him a little bit about how they're doing so far.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, now's the time to hear from Governor Evers and Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke. Here's what they said in yesterday's briefing, just bringing us all up to speed. Please.
There are approximately 700,000 Wisconsin residents, 65 and older. The amount of vaccine we get from the federal government will help determine how quickly we can get through this group, but we're going to get started with the supplies we have available now. To get through 700,000 Wisconsinites is going to take some time, but our healthcare partners, pharmacies, and local and tribal public health folks are ready and up to the task to get as many people get to as many people as possible, as quickly and safely as possible. Folks, this is the largest vaccination rollout in our state's history, and not only is it a rapidly evolving situation, there are a lot of moving parts moving very quickly.
Taken all together, our healthcare workers, first responders, staff and residents at nursing homes who are in the process of getting vaccinated, staff and residents at assisted living facilities whose vaccinations have already begun and will begin even more fully on Monday, our 65-year-old and older neighbors, friends, and family members who are now eligible, and all of the new groups recommended by our advisory committee, all together, we're talking about 45% of our state's adult population. That is a lot of people. It's about 2 million people. And as the governor has said, we don't yet have enough vaccine for all those folks because we are still not getting enough of it from the federal government on a weekly basis. We understand, based on conversations with the federal government, that our supply will remain at this level for at least the next 3 to 4 weeks. This is going to take time.
JR, as you alluded to as we talked about topic one, the interaction now coming between Republican legislators, that'll heat up next week. So let me just give prior to getting your views on that, let's just summarize this. Health Committee Chairman in the Assembly, Representative Joe Sanfilippo, he wants the State Department of Health Services to have a plan by the end of March, the end of February, that would, in middle of March, require the vaccinations of the general public. Now let me walk through some of the bills that you and I watched as the Senate committee talked about these yesterday. Senate Republicans want to prohibit employers or health officials from requiring someone to be vaccinated. They want to prohibit local health officials from closing or setting occupancy limits on places of worship. They want to require a two-thirds vote by local school boards to authorize only online classes for longer than 14 days. And they want to prohibit the immediate vaccination of prison inmates. They want to do some other things, JR, but talk to me about what you expect to happen next week.
Well, I think the Senate bills that were in committee this week, they'll all get taken up on Tuesday. I get the impression I get from Republicans that they think those are winners with their base, and also they can put some pressure on Evers, like with, for example, the bill that would prohibit DHS from prioritizing prisoners, the next wave of those who can get the vaccine. They feel like that politically is a winner for them. The Sanfilippo bill is a little trickier, politically speaking. For one, it would basically say if you were 60 or older, then by March 15th, you'd be eligible. Well, 60 has no meaning, really, in reality. I mean, why not pick 55 or 50 or 45? The reason I say that is, unless you had the vaccines, you can't vaccinate more people. And we don't have a supply coming in right now that we could adequately vaccinate those who are in the pipeline already or about to be in the pipeline, and then add those folks in mid-March and get them done successfully. The more people you add to the line, the longer the line gets, and the harder it is to get people who are in the more vulnerable populations vaccinated. Republicans I talked this week also were a little bit kind of iffy about that bill because they feel like the Evers administration has an issue with the vaccine rollout. If they start passing bills to say who can get it, then they take some ownership of how it's being rolled out. They're a little bit worried about what that impact could be like. So I'm not sure if that bill's going anywhere just yet, but it's still part of an effort to put pressure on the Evers administration about how they're rolling things out and try and get them to move quicker and add more people in the pipeline.
And JR, at the DHS briefing yesterday, Governor Evers was asked specifically about these Republican oversight bills. And he said, look, I haven't read them, but I don't think they're going to come to my desk. What are your thoughts? Some of them, do you think, will actually, as separate bills, make it to his desk for up or down?
So that's the interesting thing. Remember that a lot of these provisions were actually originally in the Assembly bill due to the COVID-19. The Senate stripped those provisions out and then passed a pared-back bill that Senate Republicans felt like they'd reached a deal with Evers on that bill because it included things like liability protections for schools and churches and businesses and nonprofits. So now what's going to happen with that bill? It's going back to the Assembly. They're going to take it up on Tuesday. Will they add those provisions back in and send it back to the Senate? So these things may get passed as standalone bills by the Senate, but may not go anywhere in the Assembly because the Assembly might take them and put them back in that Assembly bill. So we're kind of in a standoff on the COVID bill right now. I mean, and they're not coming to the floor until Tuesday. Things can change by then. They could get a deal before then. But I'm not sure these bills by themselves will go to the governor's desk because they might get back into that bill, or they might be in a standoff for a while about how to address COVID-19.
Yeah, and also, on a side note, but it's also very relevant, 27 legislators, that's 9 senators and 18 members of the Assembly, are co-sponsors of a resolution that would terminate the governor's order, which he just issued, extending the face mask requirement for enclosed areas, but I know we'll get into that later. So, okay, JR, next topic. You and I woke up to a 6.07 a.m. announcement by a press release from the governor's office one day last week, announcing that Health Services Secretary Designee Andrea Palm would be going to Washington to be a deputy secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Part of that announcement said that the new Health Services Secretary is Karen Timberlake, a name that you and I are familiar with because she was, well, let's walk through her resume. She had been a senior member of Michael Best Strategies, part of the law firm, although the website says she had not been a practicing attorney. She'd been director of the U.S. Madison Health Institute, associate prof UW Madison, School of Medicine and Public Health, secretary of the Department of Health and Services at the end of the Democratic Governor Jim Doyle administration, and director also in the Doyle administration of the Office of State Employment Relations. Now, she's a much more known commodity to Wisconsin lawmakers than Andrea Palm, who came from Washington at the end of the Democrats' administration. She'd served in the Obama administration. JR, I guess my question, your thoughts on whether she would be more likely to be confirmed by the Republican-controlled Senate than Palm?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, in talking to some Republicans, they were kind of hopped up to go ahead and try and fire Andrea Palm as secretary. Remember, there have been calls from Republicans to bring up Palm's nomination to the Senate floor and reject it since the summer, at least with these various orders from the Evers administration. At the same time, Andrea Palm wasn't the one driving that train. The governor was. Andrea Palm was carrying out the governor's request, you know, what he wanted. I mean, she was advising him, obviously, and had a role in discussions, but ultimately, it's what the governor wanted in terms of COVID-19 response. I'm not sure what's going to happen going forward because we have this possibly a vote to undercut the public health emergency next week. We have a different evolving situation with COVID-19. But if Karen Timberlake issues any new orders, it'll be at the direction of Governor Evers. So she'll be carrying out what he wants to do. I don't know if that helps or hurts her with the state Senate right now, which is controlled by Republicans, or if it's just a reset that might have a chance for people to catch their breath and just try and work together going forward.
Well, but this we can agree on this much, JR. Karen Timberlake has deeper roots in the Capitol and state government than Andrea Palm did coming in from Washington, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and Palm was brought in, and when she was brought in at the very beginning of Evers' administration, he touted her work in the Obama administration. It was no surprise to people I talked to that she was going out to Washington, D.C., because the second Joe Biden got elected, they figured she was looking, you know, sharpening up her resume for a possible job out in D.C. One, she's not from Wisconsin, you know, she came from working out in Washington, D.C. And two, would you want to work in this environment where Republicans are harping on you at every time you do something? I mean, it's just a more welcome environment in D.C. for her to work in than what she's been dealing with in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, let's turn to a new subject. Governor Tony Evers had called in his State of the State a special session on reforming the process that processes and responds to unemployment insurance claims in Wisconsin. The governor said that the system that responds to U of I claims goes back to the 1970s. He said back to President Nixon, of course, president in the 1970s. He then submitted the call for the special session last Tuesday. And as you reported, JR, they asked for initially $5.3 million, but said the long-term costs of updating the system could be $90 million. Republican legislators gaveled in and gaveled out that special session on Tuesday. And let's look at what Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke said. Governor Evers knows full well that he's had the power to initiate the changes he's asking for without a special session or bill from the legislative branch. If he's waiting for permission to start fixing the problem, he already has that authority. Our governor has shown yet again he prefers a scoop-and-shovel approach to problem-solving. Before we get to Democratic Leader Hintz's response, JR, my question, couldn't the Evers administration begin the RFP, I'm sorry, that's too much bureaucratic, request for proposals for a new U of I system without approval by a special session?
You know, good question. I'm not a lawyer, so I couldn't tell you, like, if there's any hurdle they have to go through before getting there. Part of the pitch that Republicans made was that there was already money available to begin this process. All he was asked to do was dip into it. Now, they gave us this Legislative Fiscal Bureau memo that had all these appropriations listed, how much is in each account. What I'm not clear from that memo is, one, if they can be tapped, because, I mean, remember, you can't, there are like pots of money for designated purposes in state government. You can't just like go grab money whenever you want to spend it on something. It's not sure each pot that they identify is appropriate. Two, some of those funds have enough money to cover the expense up front. And three, one had a deficit. So, you know, it's not clear to me if, again, not being a lawyer, if they could really have the power to do this. However, you have a budget coming up that he's going to introduce in a few weeks. You could figure out a way to put something in the budget, begin that process, and get it rolling. The impression I've gotten, though, is that Republicans, one, think that this is one of Evers' biggest vulnerabilities going into 2022, that he has to take care of the UI issue. They are not going to give him a win on this. One, because they don't think they need his permission. They think that he has the power to do it already. And two, again, you know, they see a big potential vulnerability here. We don't have the same number of claims coming in right now. You know, fingers crossed, we won't have a pandemic like this again anytime soon. So you would guess we're not going to have the same kind of deluge of claims coming in. So they're saying, hey, this guy's got a problem. We're not going to fix it for him. Have, you know, make him fix it. Also, if they were to pass a bill, something, they would then share some ownership in this issue. And again, they're saying this is Evers' problem. He better fix it.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's consider the response of Assembly. Democratic leader hints to the inaction on the governor's special session call. So what is the Republicans' plan? Republicans say their constituents are struggling with lagging payments from an antiquated system, but then refuse to take action on measures that would help address the problem. Just a quick question. Couldn't the Evers administration ask for a 1310 permission?
Yes.
Okay, and give a short summary of 1310, because that's stuff you and I have been talking about for our decades in the Capitol. 1310.
So those pots of money I talked about, you can go get submit a request to the Joint Finance Committee, which is controlled by Republicans right now, to move money around in those appropriations. So that might be one way to get, if you don't think you have the authority to spend the money right now, to get sign off from the legislature to do it.
Right. Okay, new topic. First ever report by the State Department of Justice was mandated, I think, by statute, that they had to ask police departments, law enforcement agencies across Wisconsin about the use of both body cameras and dashboard cameras. They released those results, I think, yesterday, and let's walk through them because it's an important issue in light of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, et cetera, et cetera. The DOJ report said 380 or 88% of those that law enforcement agencies that responded used at least one form of recording devices. 210 used both dashboard and body cameras. 170 used one device. 280 agencies responding with body cameras said they had one body camera for each officer. 54 agencies reported not having any recording device. Most of them had budgets of less than $1 million, so our smaller law enforcement agencies statewide. Costs to buy the recording devices, costs to preserve the footage, were cited most often as barriers by those agencies that did not use them. Finally, agencies using body and dashboard cameras reported maintaining that footage for at least 90 days. Still a pretty big issue in light of these incidents of police shootings, JR?
Remember, it wasn't long ago we had a debate in the Capitol about, you know, the use of body camera footage, how it had to be preserved, all those kinds of good things. So there's still some discussions there. What I'm most interested in now is the package of bills that came out this week from Van Wongard, Alberta Darling, two Republican senators, and Lena Taylor, a Democrat from Milwaukee, have some policing overhauls of policies. They don't go as far as what Governor Evers had requested this summer, but I'm wondering if there's some room there for compromise on what they're putting out there right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we will come back to that package of bills that you just alluded to. But first, fascinating back and forth before the Assembly Task Force on Racial Disparities. The West Dallas police chief talked about using dashboard and body cameras. A Milwaukee activist countered. It's a very interesting exchange. Please.
What we really need is policy that says, gives clear guidance when it should be on and when it should not be on. Most policies in the state want the camera to capture interactions between the police officer and the public. So as a general rule, if you're engaged with the public, the camera will be on. The police officer is no different than any other citizen in this state, do have some minimal expectation of privacy. So if a police officer is sitting in a report writing room and they want to have a conversation with their partner about their wayward 13-year-old daughter, do we really want that on a body-worn camera being captured? Do we want to make our police officers have an absolutely miserable experience every minute of the work day? I don't think that that's healthy for them. And ultimately, I don't think that that's healthy for the citizens that we serve.
I think that the body camera can reveal to us the evidence that we need when it comes to the judgment and perception freedom that we give to officers. It'll be like social media. If you're held accountable for social media and now you have this body camera on and we're allowing you to kill people based on your judgment, now we can tell where your judgment is, because how else can we judge the character? You can't train out a perception. You can't train out hate. But you can watch it on camera. We give you the freedom of judgment. You are a public servant. Now we can see how you serve. There is no privacy in public service. And like, when till you go home?
Now let's go a little deeper into what you just said, GR. Let's look at what two Republican senators, Van Wongard and Alberta Darling, one Democrat, Lena Taylor of Milwaukee, let's talk about four things they said they could agree on this week in terms of policing reforms. Ban training of suspect chokeholds on suspects and require law enforcement agencies to develop use of force policies, one. Two, require officers to report use of force incidents and prohibit the discipline of any officer who reports a violation by a fellow officer. Create a state board, which I heard on, and I heard today would be the first in the nation, to investigate officer-involved deaths or critical injuries. Require publishing of annual use of force reports. Now, JR, these are four things that the two R's, one D said they could agree on, but Lena Taylor said, I'm not going to be a part of a priority of other Senate Republicans that said, if a local government cut $75,000 from its police department, then shared revenue state aid would have to be cut by that same $75,000. Lena Taylor won't go there. So talk to me about this mix, the discussion between the R's and the D's on policing reforms.
Well, there may be compromise on those bills between Darling, Wongard, and Taylor. We haven't heard from the governor. Remember, the package that he put together included things that were not in that package announced this week. One was a ban on the use of chokeholds, not just training them, but the ban on the use of chokeholds. Another was a policy that would say that the use of deadly force would only be as last resort. That's not in the package. He also called for an end to no-knock warrants, not in the package. So I'm not quite sure where the governor is on these things just yet. Also, the base of the bill about cutting the police, it's all about that slogan from the summer of defunding the police. Republicans feel like they have a winning issue politically, and they're going to get the governor and Democrats on record about where they stand on that issue. Because remember, that put Democrats in a little bit of a pickle this summer and fall about where they were between supporting those who were protesting in favor of racial justice, but also that the voice within that movement to also defund the police that made Democrats a little bit nervous. So they're going to be possibly put down as a vote, yay or nay, on that bill, and how they vote might come back to be part of their campaign in 2022.
Yeah, that's a good point. Last week, we listed the seven candidates who will be part of the February 16th primary. I just want to be sure I have the date right for the primary, for the Superintendent of Public Destruction. Now let's do a little bit of for the record. There will also be primaries on February 16th for two legislative seats, and there'll be a Republican primary in Senate District 13, State Representative John Jagler of Watertown, former State Representative Don Pridemore of Hartford, and Todd Menzel of Columbus. And just for the record, there'll be a Republican primary in Assembly District 89. Remember, former Representative John Nygren was elected, then resigned to take a job running a healthcare consortium. So the primary features Michael Kunseth of Mariette. I'm sorry if I murdered his name. Michael Schneider of Green Bay, Elijah Benke of Ocado, David Camps of Coleman, Debbie Jacques of Green Bay. Michael Kunisch is had been a member, a appointee by the Assembly Speaker to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Board. Quickly, JR, any summary of these two Republican primaries before we go to your stocks?
Yeah, one thing I'm watching, so far I've only seen the Wisconsin Realtors Association spending any money as an outside group in those races. They're backing Kunisch in the 89th Assembly District primary and Jagler in the 13th. Both of those gentlemen are realtors, so makes sense to back a member. One thing I'm watching is, how do the Trump voters respond to November? Are they going to turn out in force in these primaries in the general election to show that they are still engaged? Or are they going to be turned off by the process? They feel like the election was quote-unquote rigged, to use the president's former president's terms, and not participate in the process. It's really a big unknown right now how they're going to treat this primary and if they're going to turn out.
Right. Okay. And I want to correct something I said erroneously. Last week, we profiled the seven candidates for the Superintendent of Public Instruction. My error. I apologize. Okay, JR, let's go to your stock picks. Rising, please.
So diversity. As our Reference Bureau put out reports this week, we have more women and more black lawmakers than we've ever had in Wisconsin history. Now, they're still not a majority. 41 female lawmakers in the Capitol of 132. 10 black lawmakers out of 132. But still, there is a much different body than what we saw years ago. And as I asked somebody, why are these numbers important? And the point was that the more diverse viewpoints you have in the room and decisions are made, the better process you have for people who aren't necessarily heard all the time by people in power. So, a bit of a change for the legislature compared to what we saw years ago.
Right, and a lot more GOP women senators. But anyway, moving on. Mix, please.
So mask mandates. So we alluded to it before. Governor Evers issued his third mask mandate this week. Now, this mask mandate comes at a time when the 7-day rolling average is down. It's been starting to drop of COVID-19 cases. However, it's still more than twice what it was in July, late July, when Evers issues his first mask mandate. And the death rate also ticked up this week. So we still have an issue with COVID-19, and the governor extended the mask mandate. In doing so, he issued his fourth public health emergency declaration from the pandemic. Now, Republicans had grumbled all summer and fall about the mask mandates that were based off the public health emergency that Evers issued, saying that they were illegal because their belief was that the pandemic was one event, therefore you could have only one public health emergency and have extended. You need a resolution of the legislature to extend it. Evers has argued, no, that these are unique events with the spikes in cases. Therefore, he's justified issuing new public health emergencies. State Supreme Court will give us a final answer about that any day now. But what's different this time is that it looks like Republicans are going to actually come to the floor and vote on whether to overturn the public health emergency. If they do that, it would undercut then the mask mandate. Now, last summer and fall, people told me that the mask mandate was popular with the public. There might be a price to pay for Republicans. They voted against this thing and that it just was too hot to touch politically. I asked people, what's changed? Since then, their point was that, one, Republicans didn't do much on COVID. Well, didn't do anything really on COVID after April of last year and paid an overprice to the ballot box. They lost two seats in the Assembly and picked up two in the Senate. So they're not feeling any political pressure about what they do in terms of COVID-19. Two, they have a base that has been crying out for them to take some kind of action against Evers, thinking that what he's doing is illegal. And third, the reality is, if you go outside of like major population centers, the mask mandates aren't being enforced anyway. Unless you have a local business who's requiring it on its own, you're not seeing local officials in rural Wisconsin require a mask or enforcing the mandate. So there wouldn't be any more practical change if they vote it down. You would just have this kind of political fight, which would satisfy the Republican base who's been crying out for action against the governor. Now, the governor today, a spokesman, told me that Republicans have not been helping out on COVID since, basically since the spring, and they're trying to undercut the efforts to control the pandemic. And we'll see if anybody pays a price politically for how this plays out going forward.
Okay, good point, JR. You got about 30 seconds on falling, please.
So, Capitol protests, look, what we saw in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago was troubling, to say the least. People were on guard about what might happen at state capitals after a warning from federal law enforcement officials. There was a huge law enforcement presence in the Capitol on Sunday. Nothing happened. On Wednesday, when Joe Biden was inaugurated, a little bit of a presence, but not much protests. It just, they all kind of petered out, which I think everybody's thankful for, quite frankly. But for all the talk about something happening in Wisconsin, nothing did. And the question is it because there was no threat, really? Or is it because the police presence that we saw scared people off and said, no, this isn't going to be like an open invitation, go create, wreak havoc at state capitol?
Yeah, good point. Okay, just a quick look ahead next week. Both Wisconsin INO and WisPolitics will be covering the back and forth debate in the Assembly and Senate over oversight over the vaccination process. And Wisconsin I will be interviewing five candidates for the Superintendent of Public Instruction. There, I said it right, on Monday. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for January 22.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.